This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
The real 99%, they're not here. They're home sleeping. They're working. They're picking their children out from school. But they want to be with you.
This is Chai Ling speaking recently to Occupy Boston protesters in Dewey Square.
How about we change the message into something like, let's all work for a country, America, that is good for the 100%.
This is not the first time Chai Ling has stepped into the middle of a popular uprising. In 1989, Chai Ling was a 23-year-old recent graduate of Peking University. On April 15th of that year, she joined pro-democracy student protesters in Tiananmen Square and quickly became one of its most prominent leaders. Fellow students took to calling her the Commander-in-Chief. And 7 weeks later, on June 4th, 1989, the Chinese military crushed the demonstrations in a bloody crackdown that was witnessed by the world through reports such as this one from the BBC.
After hours of shooting and facing a line of troops, the crowd is still here. They're shouting, "Stop the killing and down with the government."
Chai Ling led hunger strikes during the Tiananmen Square uprising, and as commander-in-chief, she became one of China's 21 most wanted students. She was forced to flee China in 1990, not long after she gave one of her final interviews on Chinese soil, heard here in translation.
"We should also preserve some revolutionary seeds for the next time around. I am not interested in politics, but next time I'll step forward again, if I am still alive."
Chai Ling never returned to China. Instead, she came to Boston, went to business school and founded a software company, and is now confronting the People's Republic of China once again, this time through a nonprofit she has founded that challenges China's generation-old one-child policy. Chai Ling tells her story in a new memoir that's entitled A Heart for Freedom, and she joins us now in the studio. Chai Ling, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you so much. It's a great honor to be on your show.
I wonder if we may start with that day in April in 1989 when you first rode your bicycle to Tiananmen Square. What is it that first took you there, and what happened that day that then made you, turned you into such a prominent student leader?
Well, thank you. I went over there to visit the student was protesting there on April 19th, bring some water and food to support them, and that same day that the police came out to beat us up. And at first, I was running like everybody else. And then all of a sudden, I felt this rage came out to me. And I felt all my life I've been running away from oppression. But this time, I want my dignity back. It was at that moment I decided to stop and just stand there and, you know, stare back at the police. So that was the moment that turned me from onlooker into a participant. Later on, there was another event that transformed me from just an average participant into a leader.
Well, to remind everybody, the protest started in April of 1986 following the death of Hu Yaobang.
Yes.
Who was former leader of the Chinese Communist Party, but was seen by students as something of a pro-democracy reformer.
Yes. He advocated for three reform, economic reform, political reform, and spiritual reform. And looking back now, 22 years later, I really felt he has a whole vision how to transform a nation into a great society. Because after that, Zhao Ziyang, his successor, wanted only two reforms, which is political and economical. But the remaining aging leader, Deng Xiaoping, who eventually decided to order the massacre, and he only wanted economic reform, and that's what's happening in China right now. From the outside of the world, we can see the only it took place is economic reform.
But for you, you had grown up in, as you call it, a small fishing village, well outside of Beijing.
Yes.
But you did extremely well in your studies, and then was one of the few students that was selected to go to Peking University, which was this incredible nexus of the brightest minds in China. But from what I can tell, it's not as if you had any, I don't want to call it revolutionary zeal, but the urge to protest, that it didn't show up earlier in your life. So what do you think led you to become more active?
I was not a professional politician, if you can, you know, describe a professional revolutionary. I want just to have a normal life and have hope and a better society. So when people like myself started joining the movement, that was a big turning point of that movement. That means more average people are started joining into the movement. Later on when I, joined the technology revolution in America, the .com boom and bust, and there's this, famous book basic saying you got to have this, famous S-curve, got to make sure past the first, 5% of the early adopters. So I think I was on the cusp representing the majority, the middle majority people in China. So as we went to Tiananmen Square, we want a better future, and we just want to know the truth, whether we can reform communism or not. And I think what happened in 1989, June 4th morning, when the massacre took place, and all our hope and dreams were kind of crushed.
Well, take me into the days and weeks preceding that day in June 4th, because, we here outside of China were witnessing it unfold over the media, but it was very difficult to tell what was happening, amongst the tens of thousands of people, the hundreds of thousands of people who were there. For example, you became one of the leaders of the hunger strikes that were happening in Tiananmen Square. Describe to me how it is that you decided to become a leader of the hunger strikes and what happened around that particular part of the movement.
Yeah, that's why I feel like I want to write this book out, Heart for Freedom. It was something I felt like in the middle of the, the movement, I felt like I was encountering with such a powerful force, but it's hard to grasp what that is until very recently I finally understood what that is and put that down into the book, A Heart for Freedom. Mm-hmm. I helped my husband then to become a leader. And so Beida had the first democratic election for student leaders.
But right, you said Beida, but that's
Peking University. That's so right. Yeah, thank you for picking that up. And the next thing I heard from him is, go home, wait for me. I was really shocked and disappointed. It made me really do another soul searching about my role, both as a woman in the family and also for the country, because we grown up in Confucius society where women supposed to be, obey the father at home, when we're single, and obey the husband when we're married, and obey the son if the husband dies. So the women don't get a chance to be who they are.
And yet I remember seeing images of you. I mean, you were this tiny little 23-year-old with a bullhorn in your hand, with tens of thousands of people seated in Tiananmen Square around you, listening to every word you were saying.
Oh, thank you. That was after that. And also, it was during that, soul searching, I decided I need to do something for the country. I need to do something for my own future. So I stepped my role from the traditional Chinese woman into a Chinese citizen and independent person. After that, when I gave the speech for hunger strike, I wasn't there trying to mobilize people to do something. I just want to share with them how I felt about it. Because that was my reason to join the movement of hunger strike. And after that, hundreds of people decided to join the hunger strike movement. I felt responsible for them. So I went with them together to Tiananmen Square and eventually become a main leader as a result of that transformation.
In fact, some of the student protesters later, I have an excerpt from one of them, Li Lu, who then became a student at Columbia University and was one of the also students on the 21 most wanted list in China. Li Lu said that Chai Ling is the heart of the movement. Was my best friend in Tiananmen Square. She inspired us to remain nonviolent. I fear that she has been arrested or secretly executed. Obviously, that did not happen to you. But tell me, in the days leading up to June 4th, I mean, police presence had been there, obviously, since the start in Tiananmen Square. Mm-hmm. What happened to you and when did you know that the protest was going to be put down by the military in the way that it was? What happened on June 4th?
We saw two sides of the movement. The first part of the movement, the beginning, was just this euphoria of love and joy and peace. People just came out from their shell of distrust and betrayal, hatred towards each other. And there was such an amazing sense of unity and solidarity at Tiananmen Square. That was the earlier part of the movement. And when we started the hunger strike, we realized that, we actually were speaking to the people with the love language Chinese people understand, that is offer the food in lieu of to express our love to each other. And when we hunger strike, starve ourselves, it reminds people of how the father saved the food for the children, the wife saved the food for the husband, and the family saved the food for the guests come to visit them. And we got millions of people start joining the movement to really help promote the movement to a bigger, higher point. Then when the martial law was declared, all the people, citizens from their homes and just rush up to the street using their own body to block the tanks and troops. So when the soldier was thirsty and they brought water to them, when the soldier was hungry, they brought food to them. It was amazing, spirit of peace and love. And so the soldiers, I believe, were moved deeply, and they were not able to execute martial law for 2 weeks mm-hmm. until the last hour. Through this 2 weeks period, there was this kind of confusing time, and people don't know what's going to happen next and what was happening. So the ugly part of the human nature started coming out about petty fights and about, ambition, all this stuff. So it started coming out. I didn't quite understand why we're all here together, I thought. So I started from later part of May, like May 27th and 28th, where we started getting this sense that, well, it might be an inevitable to suffer a crackdown. But none of us had the slightest idea how brutal it would be. We thought there might be a crackdown like, what happened in 1976 when they beat up people, arrest them, but none of us were expecting, or were actually all shocked when they actually shot the first bullets.
So it really felt as sudden as
you're
describing?
Oh, totally sudden. This never happened in China's history. Even I believe when the KMT party went to Beijing or the Japanese went to Beijing, they did not fire a single shot except, when Deng Xiaoping ordered the Tiananmen Massacre in 1989.
My guest is Chai Ling. She is author of a new memoir called A Heart for Freedom: The Remarkable Journey of a Young Dissident, Her Daring Escape, and Her Quest to Free China's Daughters. She was one of the key student leaders in the Tiananmen Uprising of 1989. She lives in Boston now, was educated at Harvard Business School, founder of an educational software company and a nonprofit as well, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Chai Ling, I wonder if you could briefly tell us, you had to flee China
yes.
In 1990. Mm. Can you tell us that story of how you came to the United States?
Right after the massacre, we... the student was given an opportunity to leave Tiananmen Square, and the majority student left the square, except few was basically ran over by tanks. Afterwards, our duty was finished, so we have to start running for our lives because there's nowhere we can go for safety. We did not know where to go. But God was merciful and kind. We were protected by a group of Buddhist people. They were courageous Buddhist people. They're risking their own lives to save ours. So, quickly they were able to organize a 200 family members rescue network. And so they sheltered us for 10 months until the last hour they put us in a cargo box inside a boat. And so it was supposed to be an 8-hour journey, but it turned out to be 4 nights and 5 days.
You were in the cargo box on the boat for 4 nights and 5 days?
Yes. It was quite an ordeal. So I shared a lot of details about what's happened in that boat in the book, A Heart for Freedom, yeah.
Listeners, if you have any questions for Chai Ling also, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Chai Ling, when you did come to the United States, you were still in the public eye mm-hmm. very much. You were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize twice. But then you turned your attention to, you went to Princeton and then mm-hmm. you went to Harvard Business School, founded an educational software company. And I saw a very interesting quotation from you in the Boston Globe that said, where you said that you stumbled upon the idea that if only you could become a very successful entrepreneur like Bill Gates, you could make a lot of money and set up a giant foundation and then once and for all overcome and free China. So all these years after the 1989 uprising, this desire to be active in mm-hmm. in changing China has never left you.
No. I felt that sort of eventually led me to a really powerful spiritual transformation. I felt like my life was made to somehow save China. And I tried so many ways, including try to build a bigger company and have a bigger foundation. I thought, I might be able to do it until I was really brought down to my knee 2 years ago on the plane to D.C. I had a panic attack. basically my past and my future was collided, you know, on me and that movement, you know, after the 20th year anniversary. And I made a bigger pledge to help the victims in China, but also the threat came from China too. But they said, you know, this time we know where you are and you know where your families are, and we are much more powerful and stronger now. So it was that evening, and I was met by God and through Jesus. So eventually I was given a renewed faith, renewed strength to you know, take on this the evil that is blinding all Chinese people, including the leaders of China, to do a massive evil. And it was at that moment, few, you know, a month after that, I attended the congressional hearing in November 2009. You know, my eyes was opened up at that hearing through this woman, Wu Juan, who went through a forced abortion. She was 5 months pregnant, and they found her out in a hiding place and dumped her into this place where the hundreds of women was going through a forced abortion procedure, and they stick a long needle into her tummy and inject the poison into the baby's skull through that process, and the baby dies inside her, and so but didn't come out from her body, and they open her body up again a few days later and chop the baby in pieces. When she was finishing up the testimony, we were like, just the whole hearing room was silent except cries. I never cried so hard. Things I cried, you know, I think my mom passed away after Tiananmen massacre, since the day of Tiananmen massacre. So it was at that moment my eyes was woken up. I realized, you know, through all these years when I tried to, you know, overcome Tiananmen massacre through education, through funding a software company, through, you know, established foundations, what I didn't realize is there's an ongoing Tiananmen massacre that is taking place every hour. And it's ongoing, it's not stopping.
So and you're referring, in this case, you're referring to on girls, on baby girls.
The baby girls, basically, to 35,000 forced and coerced abortions taking place every day in China.
And do you attribute that to directly to the one-child policy?
Exactly, yes. One-child policy means that no other babies can survive except that one baby are given the birth permit.
And so this is why you founded your nonprofit All Girls Allowed.
Yes, 6 months after I came to Jesus, I was called to step out in faith to found All Girls Allowed, try to call an end to the one-child policy, and try to, you know, restore life, value, and dignity to baby girls.
Now, this is a very complicated issue, even in China itself, because I was there a couple years ago and traveled around a little bit. And for part of the while that I was traveling, we had a young tour guide who was Chinese. He was actually just recently out of college as well. And he spoke very openly, and it seemed to me rather freely, about the problems that his generation faces. He was 24 at the time. This was several years ago. And one thing that he said very clearly to me was that there are not enough young women in China.
Absolutely right.
And he attributed it to the one-child policy as well. But, you know, what I found remarkable about that moment is that he had perfect awareness of that.
Yeah.
And the reason why I raise it to you is, do you see, I mean, I know your group tries to be very active in China in support of young girls, but is there already a growing awareness amongst the Chinese people themselves about this issue regarding young girls and women?
Yes. The flip side of the one-child policy, that is gendercide, and that is for every six girls that's scheduled to be born, the number six girl would never make it. They either die during the abortion, or, you know, abandonment right after birth, or infanticide right after birth. So so the number six boy would have grown up not able to find wives. So today there are over 37 million single men in China. They are called single branches. They will not bear a family or children. So they become a huge driver for sex trafficking, both domestically and also around the neighboring countries. They are also driving down the consumption, the economic activity to buy foreign goods, because they're saving the money to buy a house so they can attract the young bride. We also investigated, there is one city in China called Fujian. In Fujian, Putian City, they have over 3 million residents, but up to 600,000 people might be a result of the sex trafficking. What they do is the families start taking measures into their own hand, start buying child bride of the trafficking market. So they start buying girls at age 8 or 9 to prepare for their son to grow up to marry.
So I guess what I'm asking is that do you feel that concerted international external effort is necessary to move China in the direction that you would like it to go, if there is already some growing awareness within the country itself?
Yes, I think to ending genocide is a very popular idea, will be welcomed both by the Chinese people and also even by the leaders of China, including the people who are enforcing one-child policy. We heard very encouraging views. They basically step up saying, oh, it's really bad to do genocide. We need to punish those people really severely. But I think hopefully someday they realize what they're doing, enforcing the one-child policy, it's just the same. It's creating the pressure for the families to try to, you know, to kill the baby girls in favor of this, try to get the boy child.
You know, when you look at China, you have not returned to the country since you left in 1990.
Correct, yes.
And in the intervening 20-plus years, the nation has changed enormously. And so, I mean, when you look at China now, you wrote about this in your book, A Heart for Freedom. You said that today, few students inside China would recognize the images that came out of Tiananmen in 1989, because the country is so much more prosperous. I mean, they've had some 9%+ economic growth for the past many years. So people are no longer interested in discussing politics. They just want to get on with their jobs. You say you're deeply saddened by this, but other people look at China today and the economic growth and the expansion of capitalism in the country as maybe the most effective force for ultimate political change there.
That's a hope. It may work, may not work, but the problem is with that kind of China's economic growth, there's still a third of Chinese population live under poverty level. And, so 486 million of Chinese people are making under $2 a day. They're even worse because of the rest of the charitable world. Don't even think about China. They're forgotten ones. They're the ones really struggling. We heard statistics about 70% of the Chinese wealth are concentrated among 500 families. And, the other 20% are spread around between various level bureaucrats, officials, people has guanxi, people has power. So it's very hard for a society to thrive for average people who does not have so much connections or power, or prestige or access.
Hmm. And so we started this segment with you, with a little tape of you from the Occupy Boston movement when you visited.
Yeah.
What do you make of, as a last thought in the last couple seconds we have, what do you make of the Occupy movement here in the United States?
I really believe this represents a force of dissatisfaction in this country. If it can be channeled well, it can create really profound change for America to restore the full power of democracy and create a better society for all the 100%. But they need to be very careful, they need to be very peaceful, and they need to be nonviolent.
Well, that is Chai Ling. Her new book, her new memoir, is A Heart for Freedom, The Remarkable Journey of a Young Dissident, Her Daring Escape, and Her Quest to Free China's Daughters. She was one of the most prominent student leaders in the 1989 Tiananmen Uprising in Beijing. Chai Ling, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. I'm very honored.
Listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this and any topic at radioboston.org. And do stick with us, because up next, a new Supreme Judicial Court ruling holds banks responsible for questionable foreclosure practices. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.